Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about the idea, the way we think in this country about private property. And it has been, I think, in a lot of people's minds, a long-cherished notion. In fact, an idea that people have that here in the United States, this is a kind of a bedrock principle. And it has always been the case that Americans have believed whatever you do with your property, and particularly here we're talking about land, whatever you do with your property is your business and nobody can come along and tell you different. However, on the other side of this, we have people, and often here we're talking about people who are environmentalists, who say there is a competing set of interests here. There is the idea of the common good, and that perhaps there may be cases where, in the interest of environmental preservation and integrity, we might actually want to place some restrictions on what individuals can do with their property. And so this is an argument that sometimes has been very heated. In fact, in recent years, it seems to have been quite heated. So the question we'll try to talk about here this morning is it possible to achieve some sort of balance between these two interests? That is, private property and the common good. And we have as our guest Eric Freifogel. He's professor of law here at the University of Illinois. And this is an issue that he has been interested in thinking about, writing about for a long time. And he has authored a book that's out now fairly recently about this issue. And the title of the book is The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good. It's published by the Island Press. And he does indeed make the argument in this book that it is possible to achieve some sort of balance between these two. We needn't veer exclusively to one side or the other. And as we talk, questions are welcome, as always. The only thing we ask is people are brief so that we can get in as many people as possible, keep the program going. But, of course, people who are listening are welcome to call. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much.
Hey, thanks for inviting me.
Maybe one part we could start is with this question of why it is that, particularly it seems in recent years, this very discussion, this business of what is the right of private property, and is there a common interest that maybe trumps sometimes private property? Why is it that in recent years this discussion has become as heated and as intense as indeed it has?
I guess I would say to that our discussion of private property and institution has become unduly simplified. I think we have forgotten a lot of the complexity of the institution. We've forgotten a lot of the history of it, its sort of philosophic groundings and the like. I think that we just haven't taken the time to do our homework in the sense. I have been fascinated by the subject of property because it is so complicated, because it does have such a long history to it. Property, of course, is a legal institution. It's an economic institution. But I think to answer your question directly, I would say that the reason why our discussion has become so polarized is because property, as you already noted, is very much a cultural emblem as well. It's something that sort of symbolizes us as a people. And it's wrapped up, like our other symbols are, with a great deal of sort of emotion and patriotism and pride. And whenever that happens, it's easy to slip into some pretty polarized debate, and also into very simplistic thinking. Mm. And I think that our discussion about property has reached an impasse because we are way too simplistic in our thinking and talking about it.
Well, you deal with a number of issues in the book, and maybe just to pick one to start out with, it's the notion that I touched on when I was introducing you in the subject, and that is I believe that there are many people who believe that the idea of private property has always been a bedrock kind of principle here, going right back to the beginnings of America. And it's been very consistent. People have this idea. It's been very consistent all along that we have had this strong idea that says the notion of private property is an absolute, and that meaning that whatever I wish to do with my property is my business. And it's not the business of my neighbors, and it's certainly not the business of government to tell me what I can do. And I think one of the things that you point out is if you look at American history, you find that it has not been thought of that way. It's not been an absolute, and that over time, people have thought about this idea of private property in very different ways.
Oh, indeed they have. Yeah, sure. I think the vision of property that you're presenting actually can be dated in time. It arose first really in the late 19th century, and it never was widely accepted in the sense that it showed up in our law. That was never an accurate statement of property law. But it arose late in the 19th century, and it arose sort of as the culmination of a long process that took place during that century of industrialization, of intensive development of our landscape. And the American people at the time were very much in favor of intensive land uses, of development, of sending the railroads out and opening the mines and so on and promoting factories. These were intensive land uses. They caused a lot of harm to surrounding lands, but it was in keeping with the tenor of the times that we wanted that. And we sort of, by the end of the century, had developed, at least in one strand of our thinking, an idea of ownership that landowners could pretty much do anything they wanted. As I say, that was never accepted at law, but that really was the first time that idea emerged in American history.
Hmm. Another issue, and I think this goes to the way that we're thinking about what it is we're thinking about, that is that when we think about private property or talk about private property, and we're talking about the land and everything connected with it, we talk about it as if it was not a living thing. I think your metaphor is, well, we talk about it like it was a bundle of sticks. Well, in fact, you know, it's not, and you simply cannot think about it the way that you would think about some kind of inanimate object that was not a living thing. That in fact, you know, the land and the people and the creatures that are, and the plants that are on it are.
Sure. If you just think about what it involves for us to divide the land into legally owned private shares, I mean, we're not dividing nature itself. I mean, are the property lines that we draw on the land, thinking of the land as an integrated natural community, the property lines we draw are very arbitrary. And of course, nature doesn't abide by them. You know, the percolating groundwater doesn't, the air, the wildlife, you know, the pollen from the plants. In fact, if you took a piece of land and separated it, literally, physically separated it from everything around it, I mean, it would be death to everything on the land. And it's not just the natural interconnection that we sometimes forget about, but it's the social interconnection, it's the economic interconnection. I mean, we forget that the value of a parcel of land is very heavily determined by what other people are doing on other lands around it.
Yeah, and that's also another important idea, that is that, you know, you can put up a fence, but that doesn't necessarily mean that what you do on your side of the fence is going to stay on your side of the fence. And there also is some balancing of interest between, you know, what I do on my property on my side of the fence and how that affects the property of the person that's on the other side of the fence.
You betcha. I think nothing would move us in the right direction of clarifying our thinking more than to remember that landowners have neighbors, and they too are landowners, and necessarily what one landowner does affects the neighbor, and vice versa. And often the job of the law is simply to resolve these disputes among landowners, and however the law does that, whether favoring one landowner or another, you can't really say that a decision is either pro-private property or anti-private property. Inevitably, you're favoring one owner over another owner. I mean, and to get back to this 19th century process I was talking about briefly, where we started in our country during the time of the Revolution, during the era of our Constitution, the most important attribute of ownership for people then was not the right to use your land intensively. It was your right to complain if anybody else interfered with your land use, including your neighbors. So it really was the right to be protected against interference. And that was sort of an ideal in a relatively agrarian society where people wanted to sort of live in their homes and not be bothered by anybody. But goodness, did that change in the 19th century.
Mm. Well, just maybe we have a couple of callers. Maybe just go on to one notion that, again, is sort of, I'm sure, very difficult and complicated. And that is how people have thought about the idea of the common good in the sense that we do, as a matter of law, we do tell people that you can have title to a piece of land. We can say that, yes, in fact, that you own it and that you have the opportunity to develop it in certain kinds of ways. Mm-hmm. At the same time, there is this notion that, well, it's true that you do have title to this land, but it is, in a sense, everyone's, and that there is this notion of common good. I mean, how have people thought about that idea?
Well, it's hard today to talk a lot about the common good because it itself is contested. But then again, it's always been contested. And I want to sort of put to the side, you know, the specific issues about what is in our good collectively as a people. Let me just comment generally about this issue. We need to realize that property is inherently a social relationship. It's a social institution. If you go out onto the frontier and grab a piece of nature and sort of proclaim aloud, gee, this is mine, I own it, is that the origin of property? Well, the answer is absolutely not. That's just might makes right. That's the king of the hill game. You know, you are in charge as long as nobody comes along and topples you. Your property right arises only when other people show up and they agree to respect your claims to the land. So the question that we need to face always, we need to keep asking this all the time, why is it that other people should respect your claim to the land? Now, I mean, simplistically, you could say, well, gee, I bought it. But that, I mean, that's not much of an answer in the longer scheme. What's in it for other people? Why should other people respect your private property rights? Mm. That's the sort of justification issue that we confront all the time. Because, I mean, keep in mind, when people think of private property as somehow a private power, but private property only works because we've got the police out there to protect you, we've got the courts, we've got the government. So it really is, when we recognize private property rights in a person, we're saying you are going to be allowed to call upon government to essentially to restrict the liberty of other people who might be coming onto your land. And that's what needs to be justified. And as I say in the book, and this is probably my central point, that we need to recover this understanding of private property as a social institution.
Well, it sounds like the argument you would make is that if we ask this question, why is it that we should respect your right to ownership of the land, that your stewardship of the land, what you do with it should be an issue in determining whether or not we're going to respect that, right?
I certainly think so. It's not the only issue. I mean, the reasons why, I mean, to answer my question, why do we recognize private property rights in individuals? There have long been a number of answers to it, and the old answers, I think, are still good answers. A system of private property helps promote economic enterprise. It gives people spheres of privacy. It helps provide sort of a distribution of wealth in society, a sort of ballast to promote a more stable civil society, and so on. But your question is a good one. Given the social nature of property, given that its justification has to be based on the way it supports the good of the people collectively, the question I think that's being raised today is, what rights should landowners have to alter their lands in ways that are really degrading environmentally, that pollute the rivers, that pollute the air, that lose the topsoil, that kill off the wildlife? What's in it for society to allow people to do that? I think that's the question that's on the table today.
Our guest is Eric Freifogel. He's professor of law at University of Illinois. We're talking about the idea of private property and whether it is possible to respect that and at the same time respect the notion of common good. And when it comes, particularly here, we're talking about ownership of land. He's written about this in his book, The Land We Share, Private Property and the Common Good. It's published by the Island Press. We do have a couple of callers here. We'll get right to them. First in Clifton on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning. Mm-hmm. This is a quite complicated thing, and there's lots of things to be mentioned. One of them, of course, is the diversion of water. I don't want to delve into that right now, but one is odors. And just to give you a couple examples, I live on the very western edge of a small village here, and to outside my window where I'm looking now is a field. I'd hate to see the farm owner there come in and put a hog lot right next to me, which would be about maybe 30 feet, could be 30 feet from my property. And then also I'd like to point out another one in the summertime. The prevailing winds here is mostly out of the southwest, and here I am in the southwest part of town. Well, would I have any business of starting burning a bunch of old tires out here on a Saturday afternoon when my neighbor's having right downwind is having a barbecue? I don't think so. So anyway, maybe you'd mention that or go on for whatever else, or go to the next call or whatever.
Sure. Well, I appreciate the comments of the caller, and in fact, there have been cases looking at these very issues that the caller raises, right?
Sure, sure. You bet. In fact, I start the whole book off with one of those cases involving an animal feedlot operation, right, that comes in, just to get people realizing that often in a conflict like this, there's two landowners. It's not one. I think our rhetoric, public rhetoric about property, is in no way more confusing and unhelpful to us when we posit as sort of the example the state or government on one side doing battle with an individual landowner. Because the landowner isn't in isolation. There's other landowners. There's community. There's the people downstream. We need a more complicated picture. I mean, to go back 200 years ago, to tell you the truth, our property system was very slanted in favor of protecting existing uses. So that if you're living in your home in a settled life, a quiet area, somebody comes in, your neighbor comes in and does something that disrupts you, that would clearly be impermissible. I mean, that's a violation of your private property rights. I mean, nobody would have said, oh, yes, but doesn't the neighbor have private property rights? Can't the neighbor use the land intensively? The answer would be, yes, you can use the land, but the bedrock principle then, and it's still very much in the law, although in quite altered form, the bedrock principle is you cannot use your land in a way that causes harm. It's the do no harm principle. No harm to your neighbors, no harm to the community at large. And in fact, one way to sort of simplify the history of property in our country is to point out the widely differing ways that we have applied that principle. And I think that's what's going on today. We are sort of yet again revisiting the question, what should qualify as land use harm?
Hmm. Well, in a situation like that, does it get more complicated because economic issues start to come into it? And maybe someone would make the argument that someone comes in and wants to have some kind of industrial use. They're going to say, well, but no, this is going to be good for the community here. It's going to bring money in here, and it's going to create jobs. And, you know, you should think that that was a great thing, instead of saying that, you know, you got a problem with me wanting to either have some kind of livestock operation or whatever it is that I'm proposing to do.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, that's essentially the story of the 19th century. The new industrial uses come in. They say, we're more valuable. We're more economically productive. We bring jobs, and oh, by the way, we are also harming our neighbors. But the courts right often said, well, you know, you're right. Yours is more valuable. We're going to let you go ahead and do it. That was a major shift in the law to allow more intensive land uses. It, like any shift in the law, brought winners and losers. You know, the winners are the industries. The losers are, you know, the neighbors. I mean, goodness, if you want to know the sort of classes of people who were really the big losers in the 19th century, it was people who lived off sort of subsistence life, particularly fishing, hunting, living off the land, sort of small farms. Goodness, a lot of them lost out in this major shift that's going on today. Whenever the meaning of ownership shifts, whenever you redefine what qualifies as harm, there's going to be winners and losers. And so if we were to redefine it today, and we are, I think, slowly, you know, haltingly, there's going to be winners and losers.
Right. Well, just to round that out, and I promise we'll get right back to the calls here, with that particular case, if I'm living on my parcel and you want to come along next door and you want to put in a large livestock operation, and I said, no, I don't really think I like that idea very much for all the reasons we would expect, then on whose side will the law be, mine or yours?
Well, it's hard to say. The sort of background principle of property law embedded in our sort of long line of judicial decisions, the common law, has merely this relatively vague notion of do no harm. You know, it's the law of nuisance. If you're a landowner, your neighbor comes in, is imposing substantial harm on you under circumstances that are unreasonable, you can halt it. I mean, that's a nuisance. So that's sort of the background common law principle. But layered on top of that, we have all of these land use regulations and statutes and the like. And so it makes it relatively complicated. But it's in the complication, though, I think it's useful for us not to lose sight of the most important core issue, which is the one you've raised. You know, are we going to favor the intensive land use? Are we going to protect instead the more sensitive land use? If we do allow the intensive land use, should the one who engages in it have to compensate the sensitive landowner who can be very, very harmed?
Yeah. Let's go to another call. We have somebody here on a cell phone. We'll get them next. Line 2. Hello.
Hi, I'd like to make a brief comment and then tell you a very short true story, which is relevant. The comment I wanted to make is that, in fact, property rights, as all rights, is a myth. It's basically a declaration by a group of people or by an individual that what they have is theirs, and they claim a right to it. And you can take a Lockean view, or you can take a Proudhon view of property rights, but ultimately you can't found rights in any sort of a rational basis. And that's okay. Ultimately, property rights, as all other rights, come out of power, whether that power is a gun or whether it's peer pressure or whatever. The story I wanted to tell you is back in the 1960s when Ramparts magazine was around, and this was sort of at the beginning of the Vietnam War, there were two anarchist groups that got together to see if they could form a coalition. There was the left wing, which was the anarcho-syndicalists, who are anarchists who basically do not believe in private property and only in shared property. And then there was another group of anarchists who were called the anarcho-capitalists or radical libertarians who basically believe in private property and a free market system. Anyway, there was an attempt to form a coalition, and they had a meeting in New York, and it was a very short meeting because the anarcho-capitalists said to the anarcho-syndicalists, well, if we have property and we don't want to give it to you, or we don't want to give it to the community, then what are you going to do if you're you know, anarchist? And the anarcho-syndicalist said, and I'll tone this down a little bit, well, that's easy. We'll beat the crap out of you and take the property. And at that point, of course, the entire coalition fell apart, and the meeting ended rather abruptly. So I just wanted to tell you that story, which is somewhat related. Thank
okay.
you.
Oh, well, thanks for the call. Well, I said that I think that sort of reflects the some of the comments you made earlier about essentially about the notion that some people would argue that, in fact, this whole idea of private property it's a kind of social construction it's not a right that exists, you know, apart from us and the sort of rules that we make and how we think about how we're going to deal with one another.
Sure. I mean, I of course, do in my book talk about the philosophic justifications for property, which I think are important in this setting. And I would largely agree with the caller that you can't begin with a theory of individual rights and come up with at all a clear vision of private property. It just doesn't work that way. As I said in my remarks earlier, I think the main philosophic justification for property, and it is a strong one, and it can be an extensive one, I don't mean to diminish it, is that private property is a good institution to the extent that our recognition and embrace of it does good things for us as a people. And there is no doubt that it has. I mean, I should make that very clear, that our economic productivity in this land, our ability to sort of develop the landscape, to, you know, build factories and the like, to have homes, this has been very dependent upon our willingness to recognize individual private property rights. So I don't mean to say that that's a weak justification, but I do say that it has its limits. That if you can't stop and say, listen, the reason why we allow landowners to do X and Y is because there is a link to the common good that helps us overall. If you can't justify it that way, then we need to stop and back up and say, why are we recognizing it? If we give private property owners the rights to engage in activities that clearly are counterproductive to the common good, I think we have given them an illegitimate power. And it's time for us to stop and revisit the issue.
Line 3 is next in Champaign. Hello.
Hi. I'm interested in hearing Dr. Freifogel address the issue of air quality. I live in a part of town that shares air real closely with Kraft and Humco and some of the scents that they provide when they're cleaning their oils and things like that. So I'll hang up and listen.
Okay.
Thanks.
I wish I could say something in more detail about that. All such questions come down to the very fundamental issue: to what extent do we allow landowners to engage in intensive land uses, and to what extent do we protect more sensitive land uses? I mean, if your air quality is being impaired in a way that really affects your use and enjoyment of the land, that raises an important property rights issue. As I say, strictly applied, the do no harm rule, which has been with us for centuries, strictly applied, and it was fairly strictly applied in the late 18th century, Kraft would be in trouble. I mean, you could sue them to stop harming you. And when people 200 years ago said, goodness, we need to protect private property, we believe in strong private property rights, that is what they meant. You have the right to halt people who are disrupting your land use. They would not have sided with Kraft, you know, because Kraft could come in and say, well, what do you mean? If you make us curtail our activities, aren't you interfering with our property rights? Well, you know, late in the 19th century, our culture clearly would have sided with Kraft. Late in the 18th century, we would have sided with the neighbors who are complaining about the air quality. What we will do today, though, and again, this is sort of the thesis of my book, is up to us. You know, we can look to the past for guidance, but this is an issue that generation upon generation we need to revisit. And if we would go to Kraft and say, listen, you've got to curtail your pollution, I think we need to understand that's not somehow an anti-private property move. What we are doing is limiting the rights of landowners to engage in intensive land uses, but at the same time, we're increasing the rights of landowners to complain about interferences.
Well, is it not the case, though, with some of the things that we've been talking about, that it may be difficult to quantify the degree of nuisance, and that, in fact, there may be some subjectivity here, you know, that what one person might consider to be an extreme nuisance, another person might consider to be, well, sort of a mild inconvenience. I mean, how is it that we arrive at some kind of standard to decide what indeed is a nuisance and what is not?
Goodness, these are wonderful questions, David. this shows a very clear understanding of the issue here. Of course, it's vague. When the law of nuisance says you can't impose substantial harm on your neighbors under circumstances that are unreasonable, a legal standard like that just drips with vagueness. You know, when is harm substantial? When is the imposition of the harm going to be unreasonable? One answer I could give to you is that the law answers those questions by having a settled process for resolving them. If it goes to a jury, you impanel 12 people, you have the lawyers argue to them, and to be sort of pragmatic about it, realistic about it, what is unreasonable is going to be determined by these 12 people. And of course, if you had a different 12 people, if you had different lawyers, you could come up with a different resolution. I'm glad you raised this issue, because if you look at the phrasing of the law, you know, the law of nuisance, you can't impose substantial harm under unreasonable circumstances, the law on its face has been relatively unchanged for generations. But if you just think about shifting social values and circumstances, the law as applied, if you look at the kind of decisions that these jurors are going to be making, as applied, the law has shifted a lot over time. Because every new generation, you know, if you get new people coming along who valued the settled life, who want clean air, who want to watch the birds, their idea of harm could be a lot different from people in the coal fields of Pittsburgh who say, you know, the most important thing is for us to keep our mining jobs.
Yeah. Our guest this morning is Eric Freifogel. He is professor of law at the University of Illinois. This whole issue of private property is something that he's been interested in for a long time. He's authored a book that looks at the issue raises the question, is it possible to balance the notions of private property and common good, and how it is that over time here in the United States people have thought about that, and from time to time, he says, they've thought about that differently, and that what we need to do is sort of ask this question, well, okay, this is how people have thought about it in the past, and how are we going to think about it now? His book is titled The Land We Share. It's published by the Island Press, and we have a number of callers, and we'll take the next in Savoy, and that's line number one. Hello.
Oh, hi. How you doing?
Good.
You know, we've been talking a lot about private ownership. I'm kind of under the impression that, you know, most land is owned by the federal and the state governments here in this country, especially out west. You know, and we've been talking about, really, you know, there's been a lot of talk about what kind of hazards or nuisances farmers could represent. You know, over here at Newport, Indiana, we've got a real hazard sitting over there. And, you know, do you really think that there's any private landowner around here that represents that kind of hazard?
To tell you the truth, I'm not sure what you're referring to.
It's that Newport. Agent VX storage.
There's a place they have chemical munitions stored.
Yeah. Now, do you really think that there's a private landowner around here that represents that kind of hazard?
I would certainly hope not. I don't think so. Yeah, you're right. In our country as a whole, about 40% of all of our land is owned by government at some level, federal, state, and local. As you say, it is very disproportionately in the West, the federal land owned, and Alaska. You know, if you peel off Alaska, the statistics look different. I mean, the vast bulk of all federal lands are west of the 100th meridian, sort of from Denver on west. In states around here, Illinois, Indiana, I mean, public ownership tends to drop to down to 5% or something like that. Federal ownership down to 2%. There is no doubt that many federal land uses are among the worst. And they tend to be exactly that, sort of toxic waste things, radioactive nuclear waste. I mean, and those are reflective of the peculiar activities in which we've had our federal government engage over time. I mean, I think it's hard to think about those land use hazards, though, without linking them to the activities that gave rise to them. I mean, we've got terrible troubles with nuclear waste, of course, generated by the Defense Department. The way to think about that, though, is in terms of our defense policy, not so much our land use issues, I think.
Yeah, you know, I just kind of like to raise the point, you know, that, hey, there's more to this. You know, we should really be, it's been my impression, too, whenever I've been out looking at, you know, we've been called upon to clean up federal, you know, waste dumps. And the carnage is just immense. And I'll be honest with you, I've never seen an industrial mess, you know, like from a private corporation or anything like that, compare, even come within a shadow of what I've seen from federal land use. And I just wonder, you know, really what we really need sometimes is, you know, if they own a large majority of the land and they're engaged in these activities that have unbelievable, unimaginable consequences, you know, we ought to be paying more attention to them than to a farmer.
Indeed, we should, and I wouldn't underestimate, though, the amount of attention that is paid to them, particularly if you look at modern conservation groups. Goodness, I bet you for every you know, man year they spend on agricultural issues, they probably have got 10 human years of effort focused on federal government land activities. Goodness, a lot of people are hounding all the time. The Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, Fish and Wildlife Service. I mean, there's a huge amount of attention which is paid to federal land management issues. The Defense Department installation issues are tougher ones because there's no real legal handle for citizens to use to go after them very well. But there's a huge amount of attention that is paid to federal land issues. We don't hear too much of it around here because there just aren't that many federal land issues. But goodness, you know, go to Utah, go to New Mexico, go to that part of the country, and it's almost all the news is about federal land management issues. With respect to private landowners, I mean, I'm trying to think about which private land use is maybe the most troubling. There sure are a lot of mining sites in the West that have been very troubling, particularly those that are leaching chemicals into rivers. I mean, you've got a lot of rivers in the West that are literally sterilized of all aquatic life because of leachate from mines. The strip mining activities in the Appalachian region, too. I mean, the new mountaintop methods. If you look at what that does to some of the waterways there, goodness, it's truly shocking. But still, I'm not sure that it rises to the level of the worst of the federal sites.
Well, but I appreciate the comments, last caller. We are moving into our last 15 minutes, and the lines are full, so I want to try to accommodate a few other folks. We'll go next to Champaign, line two. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
In response to what the doctor just referred to and the last caller, the private land holdings and the argument about what I can do on my private property, and you can't tell me, is all directly related to the wise use movement, which was originated in the West, but it has organizations that are called AstroTurf. Instead of grassroots organizations, these are mostly corporate-sponsored. They call them AstroTurf grassroots organizations because they're fake in that they try and foment much of the of the interest in private property issues. Even here in Illinois, we have one of the larger wise use movements that has to do with inholding rights and property rights and what I can and cannot do. And I would like to respond to the last caller that instead of harping on the farmers, we could go after, once again, the large agri-corporate people that sell them the fertilizer that they need or they perceive that they need to put on their private property in order to grow their crops when it's been shown over a five-year period of cleaning up their land, they don't need it because most of what the private farmers or people who grow trees commercially, most of those fertilizers end up down the Mississippi towards what's called the dead zone at the delta of the Mississippi River where nothing grows because the nitrate and sulfate levels are so high. Would you please explain to maybe the listeners the importance of the AstroTurf movement and the wise use movement and how it affects the viewpoints, the movement of discussion about private property rights here in Illinois, let alone the West?
Sure. I mean, I guess I would say that if you look back to the history of property, along with just sort of the history of change generally, you've got a long history of debate about what it should mean to own land. In fact, debating this very issue is as American as baseball, I think. I mean, there has not been any generation that has not constantly visited this issue. What should it mean to own nature? To what extent should we allow people to engage in intensive land uses? To what extent should we protect more sensitive ones? So there's really nothing wrong, I think, with citizen groups coming forward and expressing a point of view. And I think there's nothing illegitimate about people wanting to favor intensive land uses, industrial land uses, which is what really the sort of property rights movement does, the wise use movement. I mean, obviously their rhetoric is very misleading, that when they say they are pro-private property, what they mean is they are in favor of a very particular understanding of ownership, one that allows people to engage in intensive land uses. Necessarily, that movement is very sharply opposed to a point of view that would protect more sensitive land uses. So, you know, it is true that the wise use and property rights movement is, I mean, to some extent, I guess you would say it's a front for intensive industries that want to keep degrading the land and polluting them, although perhaps bringing benefits as they do so. I guess I would say that what troubles me the most about their rhetoric and the response to it is that it is so tremendously simplistic. It's an image of the government going after the individual landowner, and my response always is, oh, by the way, could we please bring neighbors into this? Could we please bring landowning people downwind, downstream? You know, could we please bring in the community? Let's add some complexity to it. And if we were to do that, I think that their rhetoric would be easier for people to sort of see through and put in context.
We have another caller here, all the way from Henderson, Kentucky, line number 4. That's my dad's hometown, Henderson, Kentucky. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just a visitor here for a few moments.
Oh, okay.
I was listening to you, and a couple of things that came up. The first thing that came up is you kind of brought up the origin of private property rights and where that authority comes from. And that authority comes from the very basic thing. It's, I will kill you if you bother my property. And that's how we settled this country. It's kind of how all those things happen. And it's come on down through the ages. Now, right now, of course, you know, neighbors don't settle their feuds with a gun. Well, not very often anyway. They call the police. And the police come out with their guns on their hips and a court order behind them. And with the threat of the court order and with the threat of the gun on the hip, they make you do what wants to be done, and it's a matter of voting. The next thing I wanted to bring up is you keep talking about intensive uses, and farming has kind of come up as an intensive use. I'm getting that impression people are looking at it that way. But almost the most intensive use that you're going to find in this country is residential. When you take an acre of property and you populate it with, oh, we'll just say in a suburb, maybe 8 houses on an acre, or if you get into a more populated urban area, you might have several hundred people on an acre. That's pretty intensive use. So it's not just a matter of, Monsanto building terrible chemicals that can do severe damage. That's some pretty intensive use there. And then my last point I wanted to make was that a lot of the law in this country has been based on the idea of you can do anything you want on your property as long as you don't bother my property. And I'd like to see that brought on further, and I kind of think that's what a lot of your point has been. I don't care, you know, what you do on your property if it doesn't affect me. Some people care if they can see it. Some people care if they can smell it. Other people don't want, you know, the blasting on your property to shake their house. They don't want you to throw chemicals into the water that's on your property now and going to be flowing across mine shortly. And so that's kind of how the majority of our law has been brought down with, like you say, the thought that, well, we will allow some corporation or some particular individual to do a lot of pollution over a wide amount of area because it does a lot of good for a lot of people, and we kind of see that as all kind of evening out. Anyhow, if you'd like to address those concerns, I'll listen to it on the radio.
Okay, well, thanks for the call.
Thanks. Bye.
You've got a lot of points there. Let me just hit upon the last one, this whole idea of how we would go about defining land use harm. It certainly has been true that in the past we have largely considered as harmful only those activities that spill across property boundaries and do so in a relatively visible way. You know, the noise, the pollution, the dust, the sparks of railroads and the like. I think these days, I mean, with the advent of ecology, we understand, though, that lots of land uses themselves can have ecological spillover effects, ecological ripple effects, which might, in fact, by today's standards, be considered quite harmful, even though they're not terribly visible to the average person. You know, you drain your land, you fill in your wetland or something. I mean, in truth, particularly if you do it along with lots and lots of other landowners, the cumulative effect on the landscape can be very harmful. And I think that's one of the challenges we have today. What about land uses which seem relatively benign, that in isolation are okay, but when lots and lots of landowners engage in them, they drag down the landscape in ecological terms? What are we going to do about that? Another issue, I think, which is on the table for us to consider and to resolve one way or another, and this is very much an issue for us to resolve publicly as a people, should we now, though, be more concerned than we have been in the past about the way landowners degrade what they own without regard to spillover effects? I mean, let's say that you've got a fertile farm field that's got rich topsoil to it. Should your rights of ownership include the right to erode or degrade the soil? I mean, without regard to spillover effect, you can say, oh, well, the silt's going to end up in the river and that's harming the river and so on. Let me just put all that aside. Should your rights of ownership entail the right to degrade the fertility of this farmland? Or should we instead be thinking of ownership as more of a use right, where you've got the right to use it, but you have to pass it on to the next generation in just as good condition? I use this example of the soil, not because I'm particularly wanting to go after farmers. I mean, I think your other comments about residential land uses and the like are all well taken and worth remembering. I use the example of soil because, frankly, I think in ecological terms, there is no natural resource that is more important for the long-term welfare of humans than good topsoil. Should the ownership of land include the right to destroy topsoil? Should it include the right to destroy waterways in some way or to kill off rare species? Should harm to your land, directly to your land, be now viewed as a type of harm that the law can halt?
We have about 5 minutes left, and we'll try to get at least one more caller. Next in line is Urbana, line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'd like to make a little bit of a different comment and give one example of it, and I'll hang up and listen when I'm done. It's about the old dictum, you know, the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, which, of course, it happens because the rich usually know so much more about money than people who are not so rich. And my comment is that if you have a right to unlimited property for very, very wealthy people, Bill Gates is worth like $40 billion, Warren Buffett pretty close to that, that the right to unlimited property for very wealthy people can actually interfere and thwart the right of everyone to have some property. And the one example is suppose a whole bunch of wealthy businessmen decide they'd like to get into the business of being landlords, and they want to build a bunch of apartment complexes. So what they'll do is they'll buy up a bunch of properties, and some of those properties might have some old houses, some old family homes on them, and they'll tear down those homes, and they'll build these big apartment complexes. And they might claim that, well, you know, the apartment complex is more efficient use of space because you can fit more people on the same amount of land, and they'll say that therefore it's better. Well, they'll get these buildings, they'll get a tenants in the buildings, and they'll start collecting the rent. And then once they've collected up some money, then what these wealthy landlords will do is they will go out and buy themselves some nice big properties and build some nice big luxurious fancy mansions, and they will live in the lap of luxury. And then when they have even more money from collecting more rent from these tenants, then they'll go out and buy some more land. And they'll all get together, and they'll buy a big, huge plot of land, and they will build a nice, wonderful golf course. And so you will have, and so these landlords will go to the golf course on the weekends and play golf and live in their mansions. And what you will have is these huge, huge amounts of land that are taken up by apartment buildings, and golf courses, and a small number of mansions. And so the total number of homes available for purchase and ownership by families is very, very small. Whereas if you would, instead of that, if you would have small, inexpensive family homes on very modest, very small, modest lots, you could have dozens and dozens and dozens of houses built all over the place, and all the people in the community would be able to afford those houses. You'd have a much higher supply of the houses, and the price of them would be much, much lower. And so all those people would be able to live in their homes.
Yeah, we get the example. I'm going to have to jump in here because we're almost out of time. I don't want to give Eric a chance to make a response.
Yeah, the issue you raised has been around a long time. One point I would make is that when Thomas Jefferson talked about the right to property, which he believed in very much, what he meant by that was the right that at least adult males had for easy access to land to live on. In fact, when he was off in France, he sent back this letter saying he was shocked by these huge land holdings by some of the big landowners there. He said, whenever you've got people like that with huge land holdings and you've got unemployed people who have no place to live and work, that's a violation of the property rights of the landless. That is a violation of their right to have ready access to land. When he was writing a draft constitution for the state of Virginia, when it was getting set up, he proposed a provision in it that said any white adult male over the age of 18 was entitled to receive of right 50 acres of land. Now, that didn't get put in there. But that line of thinking continues to the 19th century, the right to property, and it shows up in things like homestead laws. It's the right to easy access to land. That's what he thought was most important. It's interesting that one of the topics we didn't get a chance to talk about was our long history of land use regulation in this country. And I think that's one of the aspects of our history which I wish we could revive. Land use regulation is not a new thing. Goodness, the examples from colonial America even of extensive land use regulation was quite substantial. And the one regulation I would note is that there were a number of areas that actually imposed maximum size limits on lots so that people wouldn't build houses on huge lots. They wanted an increased density to make the town more livable and to sort of equalize the lives of people. So it's been an issue a long time, and it's one of the many things that makes the history of property so much fun to look into.
Well, perhaps on another day we can talk some more. For right now, we'll have to leave it. Eric Freifogel, Professor of Law at University of Illinois. Thank you very much.
Thank you.